Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the process of identifying, arresting, and convicting criminals become what it is today? Modern crime shows like CSI so dazzle viewers with high-tech equipment and state-of-the-art methods for detecting the whole truth and nothing but the truth that it's hard to imagine how anybody was brought to justice in the era before even fingerprinting was commonly used to place individuals at the scene of a crime. But when a blood-curdling crime spree erupted in the late 19th century, two pioneers of modern criminology were given a chance to put their ideas to work in the race to get a vagabond serial killer off the back roads of rural France. Douglas Starr is professor of journalism and co-director of the Center for Science and Medical Journalism at Boston University. His new book is called The Killer of Little Shepherds, a true crime story and the birth of forensic science. Doug, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So the crimes at the center of this story were committed by an incredibly creepy and destructive character, a real person, Joseph Vaché. And if Vaché wasn't a natural-born killer, it does seem his urge to kill was formed at a really young age.
Yeah, I think he's what modern criminologists would call a basic psychopath. No empathy, would use anybody to his ends, and an insatiable lust to kill.
Now, as a very young man, he became obsessed, sort of out of the blue, with this woman he met named Louise Barrant, and his pursuit of her would seem to have been a clear indication that he was disturbed.
Yes. Again, standard psychopathic behavior. He was in the army. He met her on leave and pursued her for months, ended up stalking her, a proposed marriage, and when she rejected him, he shot her and himself, and that was the beginning of a long and terrible chain of events.
Vaché was put in a mental hospital after that shooting. Can you talk, Doug, about the assumptions that existed at the time about the link between crime and mental illness?
Yeah, you know, this was a very interesting time. They called it the Belle Époque, but it was the Gilded Age in America and the Victorian Age in England. And it was the birth of all sorts of modern sciences, criminology, infectious disease science, neurology, psychology. And people were trying to study crime as though it was a medical condition, you know, a condition of society. And some people thought that folks were born to be criminals because it was such deviant behavior. And other folks, including Alexander Lacassagne, the hero of my book, felt it was something that people learned over time. And this nature-nurture debate, of course, persists to this day.
Lacassagne is such an amazing figure because he has this really sort of, you know, macabre line of work. He's very interested in what he does. He has a quirky sense of humor, but he is this warm and truly empathetic individual.
Yeah, you picked that up. It was an amazing thing. You know, I spent 4 years getting to know these people through records and family heirlooms, and he was just a great guy. He was a Renaissance man and really felt that medicine was the mother of all sciences and that crime was a disease that afflicted society. And that by using the tools of medicine, not only could he use evidence to tell the story of a crime scientifically, but he could also begin to get at what it is that makes people criminals.
Now, Lacassagne had trained as a physician, but I guess from early on he had a deep interest in criminology, which at the time was a really crude science. Can you talk for just a minute or two about the ways that people were assumed to be guilty of a crime and sort of how the justice system worked?
It was quite primitive. I mean, previous to this, the standard technique was to round up the usual suspects, some of whom were brought to you by rumor and innuendo. Stress them out or torture them and wait until somebody confessed. So this was a real dawning of a new age. Lacassagne and a small coterie of experts throughout Europe knew that witnesses didn't always tell the truth or couldn't always tell the truth, and they decided to create this science in which the evidence would objectively tell them what happened, almost as if they could move back in time by analyzing the physical evidence.
And one of the things that this allowed for was the elimination of people who had grudges to bear from bearing witness in court.
Yeah. I mean, as you know from the book, in several of the villages where Vaché killed people, the villagers turned on one of their own. You know, there was always somebody who acted strange or had said something that offended people, and they would make these people's lives horrible. So again, science to the rescue.
So Vaché, by shooting himself in after this altercation with Louise, he is disfigured for life, essentially.
Right.
And he becomes a vagabond, traveling the countryside and trying to get odd jobs. That was not unusual, though, in France at the time. So a wanderer wouldn't have aroused much suspicion.
Right. Again, another similarity to our own times, people think of the turn of the century as a time of scientific and cultural flowering, and everybody did well as they did. But there was an underclass, and there, the wine crop had failed. Industrialization had thrown a lot of people out of work, and there were hundreds of thousands of people just wandering around in rural France. And this guy was one of them.
And they weren't typically people who brought crime, but they weren't necessarily welcome in a lot of the places where they'd go looking for work.
No, because here you were an agricultural community, and some people come in looking for work, and you don't have work, so then they're looking for charity. You know, they didn't have the social safety net that they do now. Mm-hmm. In fact, this period led to the creation of some of the early social safety nets, and vagabonds were not welcome.
So he took all these odd jobs. The thing that, that absolutely made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up is the idea that at least once, maybe multiple times, he got a job as a sort of teacher of children?
Yeah, I feel the same way. I had a couple of nightmares doing this. But he was educated in a monastery for a couple of years. As you saw from the photos in the book, he had beautiful handwriting, could do four-digit math, and sometimes he would teach children. And one of the testimonies I discovered was a family who said, yeah, he had our daughter on his knee as he was teaching her French and mathematics, and little did they know that he would go out and kill people horribly.
Hmm. And yet a lot of the places he went, he often left people with a sense that, even when he didn't victimize them, he left people with a sense that there was something off about him.
Yeah, he gave people the creeps.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, there's something about him. If you talk to modern-day forensic psychologists, as I did, because in the epilogue I brought it to the 21st century, they say when they meet a sociopath, there's something about him. They say something's not right, and you could feel it. And I think this was one of them.
Yeah, it was telling that at one point he's had some trouble, and he says, you know, I'll go back and live in the monastery for a while, and they wouldn't have it.
No. Well, he had committed certain sexual indiscretions, and they had had enough of him. Usually he was unable to double back. Once he had been to one place, it was enough, and people had enough of him, so he kept wandering.
One of the things he'd done, I guess, was molest other young men who were there in the monastery. Was he gay?
I think he was just sexually deviant, and he would do whatever occurred to him to do. Mm-hmm. So he didn't seem to have a preference for boys or girls. I think he was a killer and a molester of opportunity. And like many cunning serial killers, he created opportunity by stalking people.
And there was this weird story from his youth where he was, if not bitten, like licked by a rabid dog, and his mother went to get medicine for him. What happened there?
Well, you know, I think this is folkloric. It was in the testimony, but the parents claimed that at the age of 10, he was licked by a dog they suspect was rabid, and that they gave him some folk medicine, and soon after that, his behavior changed, and he started, you know, killing farm animals and fighting with his friends. But, you know, that's also the age at which a lot of psychotics really begin to manifest the symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So neither I nor the scientists at the time really bought that as a reasoning. But it was there in sort of the folkloric sense of who this guy was.
And later on, we'll get to the sort of conclusion of the story, mm-hmm. but the first person that he succeeded in killing, this young woman, seems to have surprised him as much as anybody. He hadn't set out to kill anyone.
No, he just bumped into her, a young woman who worked at a silk mill outside of Lyon, the countryside. He had been out of the asylum for 5 weeks. They thought he was cured, and he just bumped into her and went into one of his frenzies, you know, leaving his first victim.
Did he deliberately try in the asylum to behave in a certain way so that he'd get out of there?
This was the big question. You know, people think of the asylums at the turn of the century as bedlam, but they weren't. This was a period of the birth of psychology. You know, Freud was alive, and they felt people should be treated humanely. So it's possible that in this asylum, which I visited, the humane treatment paid off and caused his symptoms to abate. It's also possible that he was able to fake it because he was a terribly intelligent man. Nobody will ever know. What they do know is 5 weeks after getting out, he embarked on a three-year crime spree.
There is a fascinating term that I hadn't been aware of before, and they didn't call them psychologists at the time. They called them alienists.
Yeah. You remember the novel The Alienist by Caleb Carr?
Yeah.
And it was about the idea was that mentally ill people were alienated from whom they were, and so psychologists were called alienists.
Yeah, that was a nice little tidbit to learn. Okay, so he's committing these crimes in different places, and the strange thing now, I suppose they didn't have cars anyway, but he would escape each time literally on foot. He would just walk away from wherever he'd been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he could walk 20 miles at a clip. He was prodigious. And, you know, again, we think of this period as, well, they had the telegraph, they had telephones. They had movies at the turn of the century. But you go outside the main cities in Paris, anywhere, and in America for that matter, things were almost medieval. So villages were out of touch, and he would just walk from one district into the next where they never heard of him, and he'd do the same thing all over again.
So it took a while for word to spread that there was some kind of maniac running around.
It took years. Nobody ever connected the dots because they weren't communicating with each other. Just one village after the other would be utterly traumatized by a truly horrible murder.
Douglas Starr is my guest. He's co-director of the Center for Science and Medical Journalism and professor of journalism at Boston University. His new book is called The Killer of Little Shepherds, a True Crime Story and the Birth of Forensic Science. We'll return to our conversation with Doug in just a couple of minutes. Right now, we would appeal to you to go online to KERA.org, make a contribution of $50 or $100 or $200 or $1,500 to KERA to keep public radio strong in your community. Join the team that is KERA. You can also do this on the phone by calling 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington, the producer of Think and the host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know, is here now. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. I would suggest the $120 membership level today because we'll thank you with your very own copy of Doug Starr's book, The Killer of Little Shepherds. It's just $10 a month if you decide to become a sustaining member of the station. You can go online to KERA.org and take care of that in just a couple of minutes, or you can call 888-694-6931. We are making great progress today, thanks to all of you, and we're going to thank a few of you here shortly. But just to remind you, if you're looking for an extra reason to call, extra reason on this very first day to get it out of the way at the very top of the membership campaign, the Philip R. Johnson Foundation has offered KERA a $5,000 challenge. This is a challenge grant that's at risk, folks, to celebrate KERA and the news and information service you get here. But we have to raise $40,000 by 2 o'clock, and we still need to see $15,000 worth of contributions here by the end of the hour. It is doable. We have 41 minutes to go.
We have the capacity, yeah. Certainly, on the internet and on the phones.
Absolutely. We know. Look, we know you're listening. Thousands of you, quite frankly, are listening. So if you just call in and make a $120 contribution and get Doug Starr's book, or just a $100 contribution,
I have to tell you,
make it.
I will vouch for this book. It is great. I love many of the books that we read for the show. This one is one where you curl up in a chair and you can't stop reading because it's very, very good. It's nonfiction, but it reads like a novel, and it's full of interesting little factual tidbits.
Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Boyd. I want to thank Gretchen and Coppell, Judy Bruton in Dallas, Norma and Ken Stanley and Keller and W.D. Kimsey in Weatherford. They have called 888-694-6931 or contributed at KERA.org.
Thank you, Mary Harris in Irving and Prashun Adhikari in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Also, Paul Halebian in Dallas, Joan and Tim Abrams in Plano, Will Redwine in Cedar Hill, and Jennifer Walter in Santo.
And don't forget, when you call 888-694-6931 or contribute online at KERA.org this hour, this is the last hour today of our hour. Drawings for an NPR internet radio, which allows you access to over 16,000 online radio stations from all over the world. Our winner of the noon hour drawing is Blake Buster. That's a great name. Buster has won the internet radio for the noon hour. Thanks so much for your contribution, Blake. One more chance to win this hour, so don't wait. Call 888-694-6931 or go to KERA.org. and make your contribution.
That's right. If you make your contribution this hour of $120, you could have a chance at winning that internet radio prize. You could receive a copy of Doug Starr's book, The Killer of Little Shepherds, and you could help KERA make this challenge grant that we have going right now, which really will count on your support. We need to raise a total of $40,000 by the end of this hour. It is possible. We appreciate your support online at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931.
Please don't wait. Please do it now. 888-694-6931. Come on, we know you can do it. Go online to KERA.org.
We appreciate it.
Make a contribution. Thank you so much for your support.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Douglas Starr. He is professor of journalism and co-director of the Center for Science and Medical Journalism at Boston University. His new book is called The Killer of Little Shepherds, A True Crime Story and the Birth of Forensic Science. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think at kera.org. So, Doug, one of the things that Dr. Lacassagna had a great interest in was making sure that in all these rural districts, the medical examiners who would go and respond to the scene of a crime knew how to do a proper autopsy.
Yes, good point. You know, conditions were pretty primitive, and most places didn't have refrigeration. So if there was a scene of a murder, they had to do an autopsy right away. And this often meant doing it in a meadow or even on the victim's kitchen table. And, you know, they were often rushed and took sloppy notes. And what Lacassagna did was divide it up into a series of steps with pages of questionnaires and flowcharts, so everybody was on the same page, so to speak. And this was one of many, many innovations he introduced to make forensic science a science.
It's like the Atul Gawande system of making sure that you have an autopsy.
A checklist. Yeah. Good point, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the Lyon Morgue, where he spent years of his working life.
Yeah, now he did establish something called the Institute of Legal Medicine in Lyon, which exists to this day at the university. But in terms of the morgue was on a barge, and the city fathers thought it might be a good idea to put a morgue on a barge because it doesn't take anybody's property away. It's cheap, and the river Rhone's breezes would waft the smells away. But as it turned out, they made a bit of a mistake. The barge was often flooded. It was humid. It was cold. And it's one of the most heavily trafficked rivers in Europe. So every time a large freight tug would go by, it would heave sickeningly, and in every storm it would break loose and bodies would wash overboard. And here was Lacassagna doing the state-of-the-art science in this environment with no gloves, no mask, and he just forged ahead.
And he would write to the city like over and over,
over
saying,
and over.
Please.
It took about 25 years till they finally built a proper morgue. Meanwhile, in Paris, they've got a refrigerated morgue. Refrigeration was brand new, and these huge display windows. Because don't forget, one of the best ways of identifying bodies is have people note it. Mm-hmm. Now, in this era before television and radio, the morgue became one of the biggest attractions in the city of Paris. And it was even written up in the tour guides in London as this is a place people have to visit.
So another interesting thing in Lacassagna's desire to figure out why people did these things was that he would visit prisons and he would look specifically at prison tattoos.
Mm-hmm. The whole culture of tattoos was fairly new. Sailors had brought it back from the South Sea Islands, and he and other criminologists did extensive studies of the kinds of tattoos people had and what that indicated about either their mental state or their kind of subculture of criminality.
He called them talking scars, which I love.
Exactly. And you know the story about how he put them on his dinner plate.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Tell us that story.
Well, I was able to find Lacassagna's descendants because I wanted to get a personal sense of the man, and his great-granddaughter, who's a judge, brought out a box of his things, and one of which was the dinner plates. Lacassagne had a quirky sense of humor, and after studying these tattoos, he would have the tattoos reproduced on the family's best china at home. So a guest would be, you know, enjoying his beef bourguignon and get to the bottom of it only to see the words "death to French officials" or "my future is cursed" or "born under an unlucky star."
I guess his poor beloved wife died relatively young, but she must have been a very patient woman.
I think she was patient. I think everybody got a kick out of this guy. He was, you know, in a way, he was such an opposite of Vacher, because here's Vacher, everything malevolent about society, you know, the loner. And here was Lacassagne, educated in many fields, spoke many languages, understood literature, surrounded by friends and family and colleagues and students. They really were kind of the amplification of the dark and the light side of human nature.
Well, and it speaks a lot to the person he was that students clamored to take his classes.
He was beloved. He really was. And you know what's interesting? In an age where prejudice was winked at, you know, these people weren't perfect, I was able to see he was remarkably free of prejudice towards other religions and races. Mm-hmm. You know, when you write about somebody, you try to be realistic, but he just happened to be a terrific guy.
How did he come to understand something that we know now that you know, particular guns leave a sort of signature on bullets that are fired from them?
Yeah, this was an amazing case. He was always observing, and his maxim was one must always learn how to doubt. Mm-hmm. And he was north of Lyon investigating a murder case in which an old man was killed. And he noticed that the bullets that hit bone were deformed in exactly the same way as the bullets that hit soft organs. And he got an expert from a local munitions company who told him about the rifling of gun barrels, he took the body, the bullets, and the suspected gun back to his laboratory in Lyon. And conditions were different at the time. He was able to get some bodies from the hospital, and he started shooting them in the hard parts and the soft parts. And he put the pieces together, figuring out that a bullet bears kind of the fingerprint of the gun.
And this was something, I guess, that had been understood in the munitions business, but no one thought that it would be helpful to tell police or medical examiners.
No, nobody connected the dots. And a lot of what was going on in the 1880s and 90s was the connecting of dots, because we had all these sciences that were being created, and people like this saw the big picture of how one science related to the other.
Now, Vacher, by and large, except for the attack on Louise and the attack on himself, was not using a gun. But talk a little bit about his sort of M.O.
Yeah, not wanting to make your listeners queasy, but he did have a very effective method. He was quite a predator, and he always got people when they were completely alone. And I even found villagers who said their great-grandparents told them stories about Vacher, who was considered like a werewolf. He would grab them very quickly around the throat, and he was tremendously strong. And if you grab someone around the throat, you hit certain nerves, too, that makes them just collapse. And as soon as they were down, he would stab them. And then he just mutilated them in the most horrible possible way. Once that done, and he satisfied certain sexual urges, he hid the body, he cleaned himself up, he'd walk 20 miles into the next district, and the next day horrified villagers would find what had happened. Hmm.
So one of the people charged with solving this case was this prosecutor named Emile Fourquet, and he eventually was able to recognize this distinct pattern to the crimes committed by this one single killer.
Mm-hmm. And here was a small city prosecutor, nobody important, who just followed and read up on the modern methods. So what he did was create probably the first modern criminal profile. Mm. There was a killing in his district. He did think he saw a similarity somewhere else, so he sent telegrams all over France to all the prosecutors saying, any unexplained killings, send me descriptions of the bodies, and any unexplained vagabonds, send me descriptions of them. And he took dozens and dozens of reports and started making charts of what this guy might look like and what his method was. And in the end, he ended up with a remarkably accurate description, which he sent all over France. And eventually, when Vacher tripped up and was caught, the local magistrate had read the memo and sent him over to Fourquet.
And then the process that Fourquet had to use to try and get him to talk was really interesting.
Wasn't that brilliant?
Yeah.
One of the great writers at the time on criminal procedure was a man named Hans Gross of Austria, and he wrote about interrogations. And it's interesting, in the 1880s he wrote, the one thing you must never do during an interrogation is torture the suspect. Mm-hmm. Never. Because he'll simply tell you what you want to hear. You have to use guile and be clever.
And this was revolutionary, excuse me for interrupting, at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of sad we're still talking about it, because these guys knew what they were talking about. Fourquet followed that method, and after he had Vacher in custody for a few days and couldn't get anywhere, he said to Vacher, you know what, I made a mistake, you shouldn't be here. I need to keep you for 3 more days to clear up some paperwork. Meanwhile, why don't we just chat about your wanderings, because I'm writing a book about vagabonds.
It seems hard to believe that after all of this, that Vacher would fall for that.
Well, it was clever. I mean, as it turned out, Fourquet really was writing a book about vagabonds. He showed Vacher the files, and he said nothing about the murders. Mm-hmm. So he just talked about where he'd been, what the weather was like, and he had maps. And I got copies of the maps, drew maps of his wanderings all over France, and late at night he would also take the reports of murders and start to click them onto the maps. Mm-hmm. And one after the other fell into place. And finally, after several days of interrogation, he confronted Vacher with the facts. And Vacher was so utterly flabbergasted by this that he gave Fourquet a partial confession.
At what point did Fourquet call in Dr. Lacassagne for help?
Well, immediately after that, Vacher clammed up and started acting increasingly insane. And now Fourquet knew he was out of his league. He wasn't going to get anything out of Vacher. So that's when he called in Lacassagne, who was the world's foremost criminologist and forensic expert, to say, help me make something out of this guy, because clearly he's going for the insane defense. You know, he wants to go to a cushy asylum instead of the guillotine. And here's when Lacassagne took over the case.
Can you talk a little bit about how crime scene evidence was preserved during this era?
Well, they didn't have plastic bags. Mm-hmm. They would often use plaster to preserve footprints and handprints. They would put organs in briefcases or paper bags or cloth bags. And then they had criminal museums. in which they had preserved body parts with the weapons that caused the damage, so that young criminologists could look at the evidence and say, oh, so that's what that kind of knife wound looks like, or that's what a hatchet wound looked like. And this way they were able to preserve evidence from the crime scene and use them for teaching as well.
And that was one of the things also that Lacassagne contributed to the world.
Oh, his crime scene museum was one of the wonders of the world, and there are still large portions of it preserved in Lyon that you could look at.
Did he have a sort of weird sense of human nature, or was he able to compartmentalize people who did these crimes with far away from the average person?
I think he was remarkably well-balanced. One of the things that really struck me about him is he never saw criminals as less than human.
Mm-hmm.
So every Sunday morning, he strolled across town to the St. Paul prison, and he would spend the morning chatting with prisoners. He also took the revolutionary step of giving the prisoners journals so they could keep diaries and write mini autobiographies. And there's shelves and shelves of these autobiographies because he really wanted to understand them. The result was that you've got this prison full of people Lacassagne put away, almost all of whom loved him because he was one of the few human beings who treated them too as human beings, even though he was responsible for their imprisonment.
We haven't talked much about this yet, but by the time Vaché was arrested and had confessed to some of these crimes, this was a huge media sensation in France.
Enormous. You know, we have cable news now and all the sensationalistic news outlets. They had the first tabloids, the tabloid press, and there was nothing that would get readers than illustrations of gruesome killings. And the Vaché case was a combination of the Charles Manson case and the O.J. Simpson trial of its time.
We'll take a quick break, and then we'll talk about that trial and about the aftermath, and we'll talk a little bit about current CSI methods and what's depicted in TV and the movies. My guest this hour is Douglas Starr. He's co-director of the Center for Science and Medical Journalism and professor of journalism at Boston University. The new book is called The Killer of Little Shepherds, A True Crime Story and the Birth of Forensic Science. Right now, we would invite you to join KERA, join the team that makes public radio possible, that allows us to tell these stories and interview experts every day for you here. You can do that by going online to kera.org. Make a contribution of support if you want to give $120. Your thank you gift could be a copy of The Killer of Little Shepherds by Douglas Starr. Fascinating, fascinating read. You can also go and make a phone call at 1-888-694-6931 to make your contribution. Hello, Jeff Whittington.
Hello, Chris Boyd. And hello to you. Please do call 888-694-6931. It is the winter membership campaign. It's day one, and we know how many of you respond during this campaign. We know how many of you listen, and we know about, you know, where we're going to end up. And really, if you just do it today, we could wrap this drive up that much sooner. It'd be over for you, and you'll know during the rest of the drive that you've done your part. You help lead the way, especially today, because, Chris, we've mentioned this a couple of times, but between 7 a.m. and 2 p.m. today, we've been in a challenge period from the Philip R. Johnson Foundation. It's a $5,000 at-risk challenge grant that KERA can accept if we can raise $40,000 from you. We have heard from many of you, and we've heard from some of you at the higher levels. If it's time for you to renew your Friends membership at this time of year, at that $1,500 level would go a long way toward meeting this challenge and keep you current with KERA. We'd love to hear from you, though, at any level, at 888-694-6931 or via the web at kera.org.
Thank you so much to Linda and Howard Shapiro of Dallas, Virginia Waddle of Dallas, Molly Bello in Plano, and Sarah Sharp in Richardson.
We also heard from Carol and Lofton Witcher in Fort Worth, Ginger Spencer in Dallas. Thanks, Ginger. Thanks to Melissa Friley in Denton as well, and Robert Frick in Bedford. Thank you so much to each of you. How about you? Call us, 888-694-6931. We'd love to thank you, and you contribute online as well at kera.org.
The amount that you contribute is up to you. A lot of people give, $100 or a little more. A lot of people, you know, choose a Friends membership, which is $1,500. I think one of the coolest sort of higher level memberships is the day sponsorship at $365. When you do that, instead of choosing a thing as your thank you gift, you get three non-commercial messages on the radio here on KERA on the day of your choosing, as long as no one else has already spoken for it. It's a really fun thing to do, and it's one of those great gifts for someone who has everything.
It is. It's really cool. You can just call 888-694-6931. Talk to the volunteer who there are volunteers here today answering your calls during this kickoff day, and they can answer questions about what days might still be available. I meet many of you out in the community quite frequently who say, oh, I support the station. And I say, thank you so much for supporting the station. Thank you so much for listening. I never say, well, how much did you give to the station? Because that's up to you. But the fact that you come on board at whatever level is right is the most important thing. And that's really what we're spending time, we're investing time in trying to convince you to do during this drive, is just to participate. We don't have to convince you to listen because you already listened to the station. We don't have to tell you how great it is, although we'll tell you how great we think it is because we listen too. You already know how great it is. So why not call 888-694-6931? Why not make a contribution at KERA.org, KERA.org, and help support the station?
The fact that thousands of you, by the way, we've raised $26,351 so far today. In order to make that challenge grant, we have to raise a little over $13,000 between now and the end of the hour. It is possible. A couple of friends memberships would really pull us far along. But I was going to say that the way that public radio exists, Jeff, is it's really as if all of us who love public radio got together in a giant, well, it would have to be a stadium for the thousands of people that listen to the stadium station, got together in this station and said, yes, we want public radio. Here's my $25. Here's my $600. Here's my $50. Everybody said, yes, we believe in it. And I'll meet you back here in a year and make another contribution.
Well, you know what's crazy, Chris, is that so many people in North Texas listen to KERA that not even the brand new biggest in the world NFL stadium in Arlington, the Cowboys Stadium, would hold all the people. We need four Cowboys stadiums tricked out for the Super Bowl because they're expecting about 100,000 people in there. We'd need 400,000 seats to accommodate everyone who listens to the station.
Where do they go during fundraising time?
Exactly. What can we say to convince you to make that next step and contribute to the station? If everybody contributed who listens, the drives would end just like that. And you know, that's all we're asking you to do is make your contribution. Of course, thanks to everyone who has done it so far. You're making this station possible. But there's still, you know, those of you who are thinking about it. So come on.
This is the perfect time to do it. If you'd like to receive a copy of Douglas Starr's new book, The Killer of Little Shepherds, all you have to do is go online to KERA.org and make a contribution of $120 or more. Or you can pick up the phone, call one of those volunteers at 1-888-694-6931. Just takes a couple of minutes of your time, a couple of minutes of effort. A few dollars means another great year of radio in North Texas. Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Douglas Starr. His new book is called The Killer of Little Shepherds, A True Crime Story and the Birth of Forensic Science. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. So, Doug, what did it take when the trial began to get Vache condemned and convicted of his crimes and not excused as someone who was mentally ill?
Well, Vache really tried to turn it into a show trial. Was out, you know, decked out in an eccentric way. He acted eccentric. He interrupted. He shouted. And nobody knew where it was going to go. And finally, on the third day of the trial, Dr. Lacassagne testified. And he had actually written papers on how medical examiners should behave in court, how they should speak simply and directly and not get defensive. And remember, they're on the side of science. And I think it was his testimony that really tipped it. And if you read the newspaper articles, they were simply in awe of his presentation.
So ultimately, Vache was to lose his head at the guillotine, but he did not go down easily. He insisted on being carried. Is that right?
Yeah, he wanted to make a statement, and then they were leading him to the town square. He went limp and said, "You've got to carry me," and it was just a horrible spectacle. You know, I should say it didn't end with his execution, as you know.
Yeah. His brain was to be studied by science.
They wanted to know. Science had shown that certain parts of the brain controlled speech and hearing and sight, and they thought maybe there was a part of the brain that controlled moral reasoning. So his brain became highly prized among neurologists who wanted to examine it to see if there were any lesions.
Were they able to see any differences between his brain and that of any other normal person?
Not really, although that became the subject of debate. with some previous killers, they had found certain lesions indicating there was something wrong with them. If anything, his brain was slightly larger, which at the time they thought indicated intelligence. But no, they debated that for quite some time. I should say the debate over whether the brain structure instigates criminal behavior continues to this day.
Of course, now we have neuroscience and we have electronic ways of looking at a brain.
Yeah, scientists are scanning the brains of imprisoned psychotics to see if there are any patterns that would indicate this behavior.
You actually went and held on to, I guess, what is a plaster cast of this original brain. Is that right?
Right. They made a cast before they dissected it, and it's in the storeroom at the Faculty of Medicine in Paris. And when you look at it, you know, it gives you a creeps. But I have to tell you, about every 2 weeks in the 4 years of researching this story, something else would give me the creeps.
Yeah, it seems like a hard subject to base so much of your life around for such an extended period of time. I know you've written books about blood before, and you know, but was this one, like, does this take the cake?
Well, the interesting thing was what attracted me to this wasn't the true crime aspect, but the science aspect, mm-hmm. because these people were truly enlightened. So it was going back and forth between the dark side of human nature and the most hopeful and brightest side of human nature. And when you think of it, that's the eternal struggle we face as human beings, isn't it?
You know, I thought it was really interesting. It absolutely is. I thought it was interesting that Lacassagne would write occasionally reviews of Arthur Conan Doyle books.
Yeah, the Sherlock Holmes stories came out during his career, and he loved them. So much so that he had a graduate student write a thesis as how good is the science of Sherlock Holmes. Of course, the science of Sherlock Holmes to their day was no better than the science of the CSI show is in our days.
So it really is, CSI is based on fact, or how?
It's based on fact, but the perfection they show you in the laboratories is something rare indeed. There have been national studies showing that the state of our CSI labs is pretty raggedy, and there have been a lot of overturned convictions based on faulty science. So, it's not what you see on TV.
Is that a problem of underfunding or of poor training or of the fact that the science really isn't where we'd like it to be?
I think it's all of them. They are underfunded. The training is not standardized. And it's interesting, Lacassagne felt the training should be standardized, methods should be standardized. Most of the labs are arms of the police department, which means either willingly or sometimes subconsciously, the technicians might make mistakes that favor the prosecution. There have been some famous overturned cases. So it's just a raggedy situation as opposed to the perfection that we wish it could be.
And was that an argument that he made, too, that he thought that people who were investigating these bodies ought not to work for the police?
Yes. Lacassagne's Institute was an independent university-affiliated institute. And a couple of years ago, the National Academy of Sciences did a big review of the CSI labs because of the problems. And it said, ideally, they would be independent scientific institutes.
Where would be the ideal place for these, like universities?
Universities or independent arms, perhaps under the Department of Justice. One thing that the National Academy suggested is, because that would be so expensive, maybe legal researchers could do what medical researchers do, and that is they double-blind the studies, which means the technicians in the lab don't get a sample with the police saying, by the way, this came from the suspect, we think this is our guy, mm-hmm. but rather just get a sample labeled number 24. And they do their research based on that. And that might remove some of the conscious or unconscious bias from the findings.
Yeah, and in their defense, it could be that they really feel like they're doing good work and they want to help, but then they don't read results correctly.
It's both. There was a big expose last summer of the North Carolina lab in which technicians kept rerunning blood tests until they got the, quote, right results. There was a famous renegade medical examiner in West Virginia who for decades simply filled out the sheets of paper without doing anything. As you know, Houston's had their problems. Most people are well-meaning, but it's a tough field.
We've become, as you know, somewhat well-known here in Dallas for overturning a lot of wrongful convictions based on new DNA evidence.
Yes.
Now a lot of people are saying maybe we should swab everybody's cheek when they get arrested for just about anything. What do you think about that, and how effective would it be in ensuring that more people, more of the right people, are brought to justice?
I think there's a real tension here between crime fighting and human rights and mm-hmm. whether one has to give up the right of DNA privacy. I'm a little concerned about that. I don't know. I think that's a great question. I don't have the answer to that yet.
Yeah, it does also seem like something that could quite easily be misused.
Also, you know, arrested and exonerated, do they still keep the DNA sample?
Hmm.
This is tough.
when you watch those CSI shows, I mean, do you laugh or do they feel like entertainment to you?
They're entertainment. I mean, first of all, you know, real CSI investigators don't wear designer suits from Europe.
I know, and the lighting is, I can't imagine it's ever that good.
No, they don't look so wonderful. They don't get out and intimidate witnesses. They're mostly lab rats. You know, they don't take off their sunglasses at dramatic moments when they have a brilliant thought. And also, these cases are backed up for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Yeah.
You know, they don't solve it in an hour. As I said, it's a much more raggedy situation than we imagine.
In the last couple of minutes we have here, I want to talk about some of the strange non-scientific conclusions that preceded the work that 4K and Lekasanya were doing. A lot of people have heard of phrenology, which was this time when people believed the shape of one's head could determine criminal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
There was another guy who thought maybe we should take ear prints or take photographs of people's ears.
Yeah, well, actually, this was Bertillon, a colleague in Paris, and his work predated fingerprints. And actually, it presaged something we now use called biometry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those scanners for the irises? Well, he came up with that idea in the 1890s. He also measured parts of the body and found out that with 11 key measurements, he could identify a person down to a factor of 1 in 4 million.
Wow.
He also suspected that ear prints might be unique, but it turns out they weren't. And then there was the man in Italy, the famous psychologist Lombroso, who really felt that certain people were genetically born to be criminals and there was nothing you could do about it.
And we haven't really, as you mentioned earlier, entirely solved the question of whether or not that might be true.
There may be an element of truth. Some of the most recent MRIs do show that the parts of the brain that sort of govern mature behavior, the frontal cortex, are out of sync with the primitive impulsive parts of the brain. And that's why certain psychotics have very poor impulse control, lack empathy, and even though they know something may be wrong, can't seem to help themselves from doing it. There's a whole new field emerging called neurolaw based on a better understanding of the brain.
Yeah, I guess one of the things that is so frustrating is that even when you've captured the person who has done this horrific crime, sometimes there's just no good reason for it.
No. I mean, one of the things that really struck me in doing this research is serial killers are almost never found to be insane. I can't come up with any cases. Now, think about Jeffrey Dahmer, the guy in Wisconsin who actually ate his victims.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't found insane. You know, legally and psychologically, there are certain guidelines as to what is sanity and when is the ability to plan. But you or I or any of your listeners would say, that guy has to be crazy. So there's a bit of a disconnect between psychology, law, and common sense. And I think we find ourselves in a little bit of a limbo there.
Is your next book going to be about something really happy and light?
You know what? I want to be out in the sun at the beach.
Off the floating morgue.
Something a little less, yes, a little less dark.
Well, Doug, it's funny to say it given the subject matter, but it really has been a pleasure having you on the show this hour. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. It was really fun.
Douglas Starr is professor of journalism and co-director of the Center for Science and Medical Journalism at Boston University. His new book is called The Killer of Little Shepherds, A True Crime Story and the Birth of Forensic Science. My name is Chris Boyd. I want to thank all of you listening this hour. Also want to thank those of you in particular who have made contributions of financial support to KERA. Your money matters, whether it's $25 or $250 or any amount above or below that. It all adds up. It goes into the pot. It creates good radio for you. So we would ask that you please go online now to kera.org or call our fabulous volunteers at 1-888-694-6931. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. I want to thank Kathy Housby and Tyler for making a contribution, Keith Murray and Grapevine. Also want to thank John Lewis in Dallas and Paul Chang in McKinney. They've done their part. They've gone online to kera.org and made a contribution. It's really simple. You just surf over to KERA.org. Many of you maybe even listen online at work. You're already there. You can click on the support banner on the top of the page and support the station. Right now, it's really crucial we hear from you. We are still working on this challenge from the Philip R. Johnson Foundation. It's a $5,000 at-risk challenge. We've got to raise $40,000 total between 7 a.m. and 2 p.m., and we're rocketing toward 2 p.m. now. So please make your contribution right now.
Thank you so much to Praveen and Grishma Shastrula in Irving, John Jose in Plano, Cheryl and David Hazler in Plano, and Elizabeth Odom in Dallas. If you are on the line right now, we appreciate it. It should only take just a couple of minutes, or you can go online to kera.org. Check out thank you gifts, one of which for this hour is a copy of The Killer of Little Shepherds, A True Crime Story and the Birth of Forensic Science by Douglas Starr. If you like true crime, if you like fictional crime, if you like science, and if you like really arcane trivia.
And if you like public radio.
And if you like, it's true. You know what? If you like public radio, if you're a public radio nerd, this book will appeal to you. And I say that in the most fond possible use of the word. It really is a fascinating read.
Well, I wasn't talking about the subject matter. I was just talking about giving a $120 contribution to the station, and we'll send you a copy.
Correct.
Of The Killer of Little Shepherds. The book's out. It's available at other places other than by going to KERA.org or by calling 888-694-6931. And if you really can't wait, then make a contribution and go get the book if you're interested in this topic, because we really appreciate the fact that you listen, and we appreciate the fact that many of you, and I've read your emails, get reading recommendations from this show, and then support the station as a thank you for making these recommendations by having the authors on.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go online to KERA.org. Maybe think back to the first time that you listened to the station and had one of those proverbial driveway moments and thought, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And you were compelled to tell somebody about what you just heard, or maybe just to tell other people about public radio. That moment was made possible by someone who came before you and made a contribution to the station, became a supporting member. You can make it possible for someone else and perhaps inspire that person, a few months from now to make a contribution themselves. That's kind of a wonderful thing you can do. It's a sort of chain reaction of events that takes place when you make a contribution and join the team of people that make KERA possible.
Thanks to Carol Schulman in Fort Worth, Elise Faustino in Plano, and Joe Finan in Rockwall. Thanks for doing your part. We'd love to hear from you. Follow these fine folks who've supported KERA here in just the last few minutes by going online to KERA.org and making a contribution via the phone at 888-694-6931. It's your last chance also to get into the drawing for the NPR Internet Radio. Someone's going to win that radio here in a couple of minutes. They're going to draw from everyone who's contributed this hour, everyone who's gone online or called. So don't miss your chance to do that as well. And of course, there is that challenge on the table from the Philip R. Johnson Foundation. It's $5,000. It's at risk. And your contribution right now can help us reach the $40,000 goal we've got to make to accept the $5,000 from the Philip R. Johnson Foundation.
The truth is $5,000 is incredibly hard for us to walk away from. Money is tight all over. We get it. It's tight here. We do everything we can possibly do to use your dollars wisely and to make a dollar stretch as far as it can. But a challenge grant like this from the Philip R. Johnson Foundation is a big deal for us.
It is. It really is. It's really crucial that we meet these challenges, especially on the first day of the drive like this. And you can help us make it by going to 888-694-6931 on your phone or on the web at KERA.org and making a contribution in support of your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, and online, of course, at KERA.org.
Lots of new, cool online features that we've introduced in the last year. And I say we as if I've had anything to do with it, but we have a fantastic team here. There's the new player for smartphones, the KERA.
Well, it's for the iPhone right now.
For the iPhone only.
Yeah. Okay. There's a KERA and a KXT app that are available for your iPhone. We're working on the Droid right now. I mean, I can hear
Alan Melson. Working on the Droid.
Alan Melson, our director of interactive. Wants you to know that we are working on the Droid version of the app as we speak. Probably right now he's dealing with some aspect of it. So that's going to be out soon. And that allows you to listen to the station anywhere in the world. You can rewind if you wanted to hear that again over and over again that I just said. You can rewind right there on the phone. It's pretty cool. But, to develop those, it takes time and resources, and to offer them for free, I mean, that's crazy, right? So
we offer them for free, hoping that you'll make a contribution.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is your chance to do that.
1-888-694-6931 is the number, or you can go online to KERA.org. If you make your contribution online and you are a social networker, there are some buttons now, I think, that you can click to share with your friends that you've made a contribution. We would ask if you would be willing to take the extra 5 seconds to do that. That's a really good way that you can evangelize for us. Maybe your friends don't know that all their friends contribute to public radio, and maybe this will inspire somebody you know to get on board.
Yeah, it would be great if you would if you're a Twitterer, if you could tweet about the fact that you supported KERA, or if you're a Facebook person, maybe just let everybody know, let all your friends know that you supported KERA and that it'd be really great if they would join you, because really it takes everybody. And this is a time of year when we're reassessing and looking at how our year is going to be personally as well as professionally, as well as the organization here at KERA. And it's a chance for you and your friends and all of your virtual friends who listen to KERA to come together and support the station right now when it's really crucial that we make the goals, that we hear from you. Again, the number is 888-694-6931, or you can do it online at kera.org.
Again, the number, 1-888-694-6931, or you can go online to kera.org. It just takes a few seconds. If you choose to make the phone call, you'll talk to one of our lovely volunteers. And if you go online, you can also check out all of our thank you gifts there. Again, kera.org or 888-694-6931.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.